This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I am your host, Mike Rappin. With me this week are two awesome human beings, Nick White.
Hey.
And Paul Jaisley.
Hi.
I'm so excited that you guys are here with me this week. We're going to do the things that we do every single week, which is talk about what we read the past week, comic picks for this upcoming week, and our primary topic or focal topic for this week is going to be about guilty pleasures, comic book guilty pleasures and the types of comics that they are and why we feel shame for them. So, but before we get to all that, we're actually going to talk about what we read. So, Paul, why don't you kick us off with what you read this week and maybe tell us a little bit about how your week was.
Well, it was a good week. I'm enjoying some vacation time of sorts up north of my parents' place in Traverse City. So I took advantage of the Cherry Capital Comic Con this morning. I spent way too much money digging through the 50-cent and dollar bins that I could find.
Nice.
So I have plenty of reading to get done over the next couple weeks. So
who was the biggest person they brought in, Paul? In your opinion,
the one name I recognized and was kind of impressed by was Larry Hama, the guy who wrote all the G.I. Joe comic stuff. So
yeah,
that was a pretty big name for a smaller con like this, and yeah, it was a lot of fun. So
I heard that the creator of Ren and Stimpy was there too.
Yeah, creator, but one of the animators, Bob Camp.
Oh,
he
one
was
of the
there.
Okay,
and then Dante from Clerks, whose real name I'm blanking on, but it was funny when you walked into the convention, they had a big bed sheet that they spray painted "I assure you we are open" on it and hung it up right from the sign, since he was like kind of the main guest.
I assume
really
that's
fun.
A Clerk's joke.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
1994 calling, Nick. Get on board. Yeah.
1994 calling. You're 8. Shouldn't be seeing this movie.
Right. So, like I said, I have plenty of books to read in the upcoming weeks, but this past week, it was obviously pretty big both in quantity and importance, I guess, this week. We had Justice League number 50, which is the final issue of the big Darkseid War, and I remember being so enthusiastic about the Darkseid War when it started, This was like most superhero event comics. It was probably two issues too long. It kind of dragged to the end, but
gotcha.
The big oversized 50th issue was... It was weird because it was obviously setting up the events that took place in DC Universe Rebirth number one that came out as well this week. Mm-hmm. But there's some good moments in there. There's a really good Mr. Miracle, Big Barda moment that got me all choked up. So it was a fun book. Really enjoyed that for the most part. I also...
Jack Kirby stuff, surprise.
Yeah, new guy. Anything with the New Gods, I was getting all emotional.
We know how this works.
I also read DC Universe Rebirth number one, which I think we'll have... all of our thoughts on in a little bit here, so I'll table my initial thoughts for now. I also picked up Punisher number one, and if you know me at all, you know that I'm not a big Punisher fan. It's never a character I've been into, but the name Becky Cloonan on the cover was enough to get me to buy it, and I enjoyed it. It was what I wanted or expected a Punisher comic to be. I'm not sure it's exactly still my cup of tea. I did kind of like that it was the Punisher that I liked from the season two of Daredevil, where it's just Punisher as this almost force of nature, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not like he's not just a guy with guns. It's like he's like an urban legend or a myth. And I like that approach to it. So I might stick with that for a while. Steve Dillon's art, I recognize it's good, but it doesn't quite have the dynamism that I'd probably want from this story. If Becky Cloonan was drawing it, it'd probably be my favorite comic. I'll put it
that way. That would be astounding.
That would be insane. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
I love her so much.
And then they could have
so
a crossover between that and Gotham Academy.
Yeah. There you go.
Make that happen. You know, DC and Marvel, let's bury this bad blood and let's make this happen.
As someone that remembers buying and reading Punisher Meets Archie when it came out in the 90s, I'm fully aboard for that idea. So, the other stuff I read this week, I actually took advantage of the Comixology Unlimited. So I signed up for that and read a bunch of stuff. I read the first volume of Bitch Planet, the first collection, issues 1 through 5. And I really want to like that book, but there are some...
You're not allowed to say you don't like that book, Paul. It's right on the list with Lumberjanes. You're not allowed to say it.
It's a very good premise. I really like the ideas behind it. I think it's a very clever book. But the art and some of the execution of the story just really kind of take me right out of it. So it's a book I really desperately want to enjoy, but I find myself getting distracted by the mechanics of it instead of really focusing on the story. But that's all I'll say for now. I also started my sort of semi-annual reread of Jaime Hernandez's Love and Rockets. I had lent out my copy of Maggie the Mechanic to a friend a long time ago, and I realized I didn't have it on hand and I wanted to start reading it again. Luckily, it was on Comixology Unlimited, so I started reading that about 50 pages in, and it's even better than I remembered. So I'm anxiously awaiting rereading all 30 years worth of Love and Rockets this summer. So yeah, keep checking in with me on that to see how much I'm loving that book all over again. So
yeah, cool. Nick, what did you read this week? And how's your week been? That too. I'll throw that in there as well.
It's been a pretty good week for reading. It's also been a pretty productive week for comics in general. I hadn't been to my comic book store for 3 weeks, so I had a lot of stuff waiting for me. A lot of stuff.
Right.
And so I picked up a bunch there, and then I also picked up a bunch over at Vault. Got my hands on the Trevor Hairsign variant for Divinity Number 2, which I think is an incentive variant. So that was a major score because I paid cover price on that. Beyond that, I read 4001 AD, finally. Really enjoyed it. I think they did a fantastic job with the David Mack edition at the beginning to try to offer readers that couldn't or didn't want to read Rye 1 through 12 to sort of get them up to speed. It seemed like it was a really good introduction.
But I agree.
Then again, that's coming from someone who read all of that, so it's always really hard to say, oh, this seems really digestible. And sometimes it isn't. But I thought it was great. I thought the ending of the issue was a little confusing, maybe a little anime-ish with New Japan, minor spoilers, transforms into a moving dragon apparatus called the Komodo Protocol.
I love that. It was so cool. It was so like Gundam Wing. I was
God. And that's why I sort of rolled my eyes. And I also thought some of the action scenes were a little confusing. I'm not the person that believes in hand-holding all the time with certain sequences, but I think there were a lot of spots where it kind of was really confusing what was going on between New Japan and the XO Knight. It's called the XO Knight, right, Mike?
Yeah, yeah.
That apparatus. Like, when it started breaking New Japan, and so, like, the levels of the simulation in the dinosaur park were, like, shattering, and then you're, like, seeing the outside of it, and you're like, am I seeing the outside layer of New Japan, or am I seeing actual space, or... but of course I read into that in the way that an English major does and said, well, you know, this is really disorienting and confusing, and I think that's supposed to give us the feeling of the people of New Japan who are feeling the exact same way, and that's we're emoting with them. And then somewhere out there, Matt Kent is like, oh, Nick White fucking just saved my ass. Like, that part was supposed to be confusing, and he read into it too much, and basically came to his own conclusion on that. So, but still, really great book. Really can't wait for issue two of that. I read a little more of Darwin Cook. I read Jonah Hex 33. The more I sort of slowly go through what Darwin Cook reading I have left, I think there's obviously a lot of praise for Parker and a lot of praise for New Frontier, and neither of those things are undue. But the more I read what little he did of Jonah Hex, it just really seems pitch perfect. Like his art for that book. I could have him draw that book forever, and I think I would totally love it.
You'll have to let me know when you read issue 50 of Jonah Hex that he did, because that might be like one of the most beautiful looking comic books I've ever read. It is a perfect issue. It's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, him drawing Jonah Hex is I love it. I can't get enough of that. I read Five Ghosts Volume 2, which again, is it really just sort of Indiana Jones meets I don't know, like some sort of fantasy sci-fi elements? Sure. But it's definitely one of the fastest trades I've ever read, and that's not a dig against it. That's actually more of a compliment when a book just flows that fast. But the biggest thing I read was Wrath of the Eternal Warrior 7. This is the beginning of the Labyrinth arc, which was preceded by the very catchy named two-issue arc called Prelude to Labyrinth. You don't get much better than that. And it sort of follows on the end of the first arc, where you discover that the Eternal Warrior has indeed come back from the dead and has rejoined the Land of the Living. But he's rejoined the Land of the Living in this weird sort of scientist's lab, who you find out is this guy called Sovereign, who is somewhat like Eternal Warrior, but not quite.
There's way too many David Bowie references in here. I'm just
exactly.
I'm pulling Venture Bros. I'm pulling Labyrinth. Yeah. I'm like, whoa, hold on a second.
I'll do you one further. Sovereign's signature thing is that he has heterochromia, which is obviously not exactly what David Bowie has. Right. David Bowie damaged his eye, and that's why it's like that. But Sovereign has heterochromia, and much like the Eternal Warrior, he is sort of immortal, but while Eternal Warrior dies, comes back, and retains his memories and stays in his own body, Sovereign has sort of a resurrection, reincarnation sort of thing, where he comes back, but in a different body, or in a different part of the world, or a different ethnicity. He literally could be reborn anywhere on the globe, and he's continuing to try to get his hands on the Eternal Warrior, to figure out his secret to immortality. And so he's actually finally caught him, and he's got him in this lab, and he's trying to figure out exactly what makes him tick. And it's sort of like this Matrix Tron-esque simulation lab with all these virtual simulations and whatnot. It's really, really, really interesting. I can't wait to see what they do with that, because I think there's so many different directions they could go with that.
Cool. Cool. Well, for me, I had a pretty busy week, all things considered, but I did manage to sit down and read a bunch of comics, got through some of my digital pulls, some old books that I bought a while back, The Eyes of the Cat, which is Alejandro Jodorowsky, and Moebius, which is a very strange little one-shot story about a man who fetches cat eyes, and I think it's above me. I think I just am too stupid to understand what was actually going on in that story, and I'm okay with that because it was absolutely beautiful. Moebius' art is obviously, for those of you who have never seen Moebius' art, look it up, Moebius. It's got the O and the E mashed together, but if you search that name, that person's art is some of the most beautiful art you can find. It was cool. It was nice. It was something that I picked up just out of the blue a long time ago and figured I'd dive into my backlog of digital books and just take a read. And it was good. It was very interesting. I read a submit book called Aether and Empire, which was a World
That's
War
II. That's one of
II.
Your most popular ones, right? I think.
Yeah, I believe. Yeah, it's pretty popular on Comixology Submit. And I figured, I happened to grab it a while back. Actually, through Comixology Submit. No, that I didn't buy it. I was reading it through Comixology Submit. Or Comixology Unlimited, sorry. But this is a Comixology Submit book. Nonetheless, I read it. It's steampunk. There are, flying ships, and there's a naval ship, and everyone's fighting, and everything's exploding, and people are dying, and everyone's British. And it kind of rubbed me the wrong way, because the story was really all over the place. It was really cool, visually very interesting to see two airships duke it out in the sky. But ultimately, I don't know if I'm going to keep reading it. I wasn't really drawn into the story. It's very interesting if you're into really cool futuristic, but late 1800s era steampunk style stories. This is definitely a book for you. I sat down and read Scott Pilgrim Volume 2 because I'm rereading the Scott Pilgrim series because I'm watching that movie in 2 weeks with a bunch of friends and we're all reading the book together.
Recolored or original?
The original. I only own the original. I'm reading it in black and white, which is great. I sat down and read Private Eye last night from beginning to end, and man, nice. That book is long, and man, that book is cool. Oh, Marcos Martin's art is so freaking perfect. I love that book. Oh, it's so good. I bought it all digital, and I managed to snag the hardcover at Midtown Comics. Oh, it's a beast to try to read. You're turning your head literally left and right just to get across this very, very wide landscape style book. So that was, fantastic read. If you haven't read this book, go pick it all up online or go to your comic shop and drop the well-deserved $50 for the hardcover. It's so, absolutely fantastic.
Mike, did you think it read differently in the printed edition, in the hardcover? Because I remember buying the issues when it was coming out.
Yeah.
Right from the panel syndicate. And I had a really hard time. I was reading it on my laptop. I'm like, I'm really not enjoying this reading experience. Like the idea that it was just digital, and I have a hard time doing that. It's sitting there and just reading. I knew I could have put it on my iPad, but once you're dealing with transferring PDFs, I'm an old fuddy-duddy. I can't really. I don't know. But I've been waiting for it to come out in a published edition, in a hardcover, for me to finally sit down and read the whole thing, start to finish. I'm just wondering if you noticed a big difference in the reading experience.
Yeah, I actually was thinking about that. I got halfway through the book. And I kind of was, I felt like reading it in the physical form was super jarring. Like, a lot of the really interesting work that I think they did for the digital format, like the page layout and like mirroring pages by you know, if you go forward, like, you, because you, when you're reading it, you only see one page at a time, or at least that's the intent, right? Yeah. So seeing pages side by side kind of threw me off, because the mirroring effect that they did in some of the issues was just totally washed away.
I see.
I think it took away from that. On top of it being a very cumbersome book to actually sit down and read, like, you need to have a large flat surface for you to read it on. Otherwise, it's impossible to read. The pages are
super actually
wide.
Like a required wingspan for your arms if you don't. They don't reach a certain length.
And it's really interesting, because like I felt like I was really worried that I was going to rip the pages because they were so wide. Like they weren't equal height and width, so like they're just very long pages, and I felt like I was damaging the pages sometimes when I was turning it.
Reading is tough and scary, guys. I wouldn't recommend it.
It was very interesting. I mean, I think that in a printed edition, this book is gorgeous. Like, the colors pop. The everything about this book, the way that it's printed and finished, is fantastic. So I still recommend reading it, but it is a little bit jarring, I think.
Okay.
Because, like I said, I definitely think the pages weren't necessarily meant to be side by side in some places. Like, they did a really good job, I think, in the digital version by, like, forcing reveals to happen on the next page, and you didn't have any idea that they were coming. Whereas in the physical pages, you're seeing...
It's just,
you know,
right,
like,
there.
Yeah, it's just right there. Because, you know, as comic book readers, sometimes, you know, we'll scan a whole two-page layout, or we'll scan two pages side by side, and you get a little bit of that reveal, and that buildup is lost in that book. Because I think, like I said, they did a really good job of building things up page by page. So that was a really interesting thing that I noticed. But yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Paul.
But
otherwise, I read Jonesy number 4. I marked 3 in our notes, but I read Jonesy number 4 this week, and apparently that's not the end of the book, even though it's a 4-issue miniseries. So I think next issue is going to be the last issue, or maybe now it's ongoing. And if it's ongoing, that makes me super happy, because this is the cutest, most fun book you can read. But if not, you know, I'm happy with it being done, because, you know, good finalized books are actually rare and sometimes, you know, underappreciated. So. Yes. Otherwise, I read DC Rebirth number 1, and, you know, we'll talk about that, I guess. We'll talk about that now, since we've all talked about our comic picks.
Yeah.
We all read DC Universe Rebirth number 1 really quickly. I mean, maybe in a couple minutes. What did you guys think about this? Being two big DC fans, I'd love to hear your opinions, because I walked into this book and I was a little lost.
I mean, that's why I wanted to talk about it with you guys, because I think we all have different histories and experiences with DC Comics. I mean, I've been reading DC Comics and have been following DC Comics basically as long as I've been able to read. Like, the first comics I read were DC. It's always been the books I gravitate the most to. So I'm really familiar with the mythology and the universe and the continuity and all that. As a sort of standalone single issue, I really enjoyed it. I like Wally West as a character. I don't know... There might be some mild spoilers. We'll try not to spoil too much, but I can't imagine you're listening to this, you haven't read it or had it spoiled to by it yet. But
yeah, the internet's done a terrible job of keeping this book under wraps, I think.
But I think the stuff I enjoyed about the book was the stuff that wasn't the big shocking reveals. The little character moments, I mean, seeing Wally West trying to reconnect with these older characters, I really enjoy that. And I like, for as many other problems I might have with the sort of metatextual things that Geoff Johns is doing with the book, I do like the fact that he is stressing that DC in its continuity has always been linked to interpersonal relationships. It's characters having that personal history with each other, sometimes romantic, sometimes it's the mentor, but that's always been the legacy aspect of DC that I've really enjoyed. There are other things in the book that I'm not a big fan of, but as a story, as a standalone issue, I sat and read, and I liked that it was 60 pages for $3. I felt like I got my money's worth.
Oh, man.
I really enjoyed it as like a single issue. I got to say, I love Ivan Reis's artwork. I love that guy drawing superheroes. Something about his, and I can't remember what chapter. I think he did the third chapter in the book. But when he draws like Aquaman, it looks like Jim Aparo's Aquaman. He's got this sort of like very sort of iconic look when you draw superheroes that I just love. As far as the metatextual elements of the book, the implication that Geoff Johns is making is that what makes DC special is that it's always been optimistic and full of hope, and there's been this force that's made it dark and gritty and grim. once you think about that for more than a couple minutes, it's totally undermined by Jeff Johns' own writing career at DC. But I as a concept, I like that. It's like, well, look, superheroes should be optimistic. And look, we've been chasing this idea of gritty realism for too long. Let's take a step back and try a different approach. That's really appealing. I just don't think they're going to be able to do it line wide. So as a sort of comic book standalone story, yes, I liked it. As a sort of mission statement for the publisher going forward, it doesn't quite work. So that's my elevator pitch take on it, I guess.
Yeah. Nick, what about you?
I think Paul's completely right. I think you have to ask, okay, DC, you're going to talk the talk about optimism and hope and, you know, standing up for what you believe in. But is DC going to walk the walk on this? And as Paul said, like, if Jeff Johns' track record is anything, you know, who's to say that we can really believe this with confidence? I mean, the book seems a little bit heavy-handed and forced when it comes to, like, oh, you gotta believe in hope, and I wish I had some of the quotes on hand, but it was very much talking about it instead of actually enacting it. For someone who started with the New 52 primarily in terms of DC, I kind of came into this with a decent amount of apprehension because the general things I'd been hearing, and I tried to avoid anything overt, but of course, if your device has got Wi-Fi enabled, you're still going to hear a couple things here and there, one way or another, was that if you started with the New 52, which was the whole point of the New 52, was to reset things and give an approachable starting point or a launch pad, that this was going to basically say, oh, wasn't it just sort of a weird bad dream we all had for those 5 years when you tried to acclimate to comics? And yeah, in some ways, this sort of came across like, and they say it a bunch of times, you know, this is about legacy now. There were definitely some quotes about that whole idea that, you know, something is wrong with history. Someone has infected it, yeah. I think was the quote. Yeah. And sort of the implication that, like, well, you know, the New 52, like, everyone felt that there was something wrong with that, right? And for me, I was like, no. I mean, there were things wrong with it, let's be clear. But I'm not talking about, like, narrative things. I'm talking about the New 52 on the whole. But if you're going to tell me that, like, I should have been feeling something, you know, the hairs rising on the back of my neck and going, something is weird here. No, of course not. So I kind of didn't really like that. In addition, this Wally West character, understandably for someone who joined up with the New 52, is someone I don't even know. And for not being a Flash person, I've never really dug back into that stuff either. That's not to say he wasn't unrelatable, but it's always sort of weird when they take a chance on making the narrator and the protagonist a character that someone who maybe started reading in the last 5 years doesn't even know. Beyond that, of course, there's the whole implications of there now being two Wally Wests and quote-unquote the real Wally West that everyone should be crying a tear over is white, and the one who, you know, we've had for a while now, or the, you know, now the bench warmer is African-American, and of course, there are issues with that. Beyond that, I mean, I thought the art was good. I thought thematically it was interesting. I did like how we bounced around to a couple different characters. I thought the Green Arrow stuff was all right. I was okay with it not being Green Arrow and Black Canary forever and ever, you know, BFFs. So I realized there's a lot of fan service in bringing them back together. But I don't know. I think the other thing that I sort of really bugged me was at the end of page one, when you've already read page one, and it goes, by the way, have you read Superman 52 and Justice League 50? I might not have those numbers exactly right. And it's like, might want to. And I'm like, what do you mean? Now that I've started this, you know, you want to tell me this?
And neither of those issues you can just pick up and read on their own, because you'd have to have read, you know, the Final Days of Superman and the Darkseid War to make those issues make any sense. So,
yeah. It seems interesting, though. The Watchmen stuff, who knows where they're going with that? I would love to know how they got permission and the rights to do all of that. And I would really love to know how much of an influence we're going to see Watchmen in the future and in what sort of issues as well. Because, I mean, that's also what we have to remember, is that we're not going to get another issue where it's going to bounce around like this one. We're apparently just going to feel the impact of this in whatever books we choose to continue. So some of us might not even get the full grasp of where this is going unless we're really reading DC all the time, 24/7, 365.
As a person who...
What about you, Mike?
I was going to say, as a person...
Someone who's coming in, who tried the New 52 and then quite deservedly dropped off.
Well,
Or diminished.
My thought was, you know, I've never been a big DC fan. I read some DC right before the New 52, particularly the Batwoman run in Detective Comics, and I still love that series to this day. But, you know, reading this... I was like, I knew of Wally West, so I guess I'll take a step back. I spent my whole night on Friday catching up on the last season of Flash, so I caught up, and okay. I was like, all for the Speed Force, all for all this different stuff, and I was like, yeah, Barry Allen, wait, this isn't Barry Allen, wait, there's Wally West, I mean, but it's not the Wally West that I know, but I know that Wally West is a character. So like, I kind of had this weird grasp on things, and I was fully all involved in the Speed Force, because the last couple of episodes of The Flash were all about the Speed Force, and I absolutely love that show. If you haven't watched it, stop listening to this podcast. Go watch that show. But nonetheless, I didn't know what was actually happening. I had a ton of stuff spoiled for me on the internet leading up to, you know, actually sitting down and reading the comic. So I felt like I knew a lot of what was going to happen. I missed out on a lot of different pieces. I have like very little bits of information about all the various characters that were touched on. I knew that Barry Allen died during Crisis on Infinite Earths. I knew that he came back. I knew that Flashpoint was a thing. I know that it started the New 52 or something. And then I don't know. So like essentially like I had a lot of questions, but I did that thing that I keep telling people to do, or we keep telling people to do, where you kind of just need to roll with the punches and things will eventually be explained to you. And if you're really curious, do some research. Of course, I didn't do any research, but don't think I'm going to keep following this Rebirth stuff unless I have a really good reason to, because I was really just off put by a lot of it. Like, I don't know what's going to come next. The end of it was kind of, it was all like a prelude to something that's bigger. And I don't know, like, nothing really drew me in to say, I got to keep reading this comic, or I got to, you know, look at what's coming out and then just keep up with that. If anything, I think we've said this a million times, you know, like, we've talked about Rebirth a couple times. The only book that I'm probably going to read is Hellblazer, and I don't even know how that's going to tie into all this, because John Constantine only showed up for a half a second in this book.
Like one panel.
Yeah, he was in there with one panel with Swamp Thing, and those are the two characters that I like in the DC Universe, so how things play out with those guys is all I really care about.
Nobody Baker,
which is not surprising, because I don't think Animal Man is a big enough character for them to tie in to the big, you know, the rest of the universe yet.
So not to jump in too much or to
totally
distract too much, but when I was reading this, I was thinking almost like beat by beat, this is like a condensed version of Grant Morrison's Animal Man run. There were so many moments in here that I was remembering, or callbacks to Grant Morrison's Animal Man, which is like Grant Morrison's first book he did for DC, and it was clearly
textual.
Yeah, and it was a big influence on Geoff Johns. I think it's easy to forget just how much Geoff Johns borrows from, and that's putting it politely, like, it borrows from Grant Morrison. But in Animal Man, I mean, the end of Animal Man is this long meditation about the loss of hope in superhero comics. You have these characters like. So, like, the Psycho Pirate is the only person that remembers the multiverse existed, and elements of the, since after the Infinite Crisis, and elements of the multiverse start showing up again. Mm-hmm. Then you get Ultraman, the evil Superman shows up, and he turns into this giant muscle-bound, like, lunatic who's screaming that we need gritty realism in comics. It's over the top, and it's not subtle. It's an attack on the Watchmen, the post-Watchmen superhero trend.
Right.
So reading that, it's like, okay, we're still doing this Morrison versus Alan Moore thing that's been pulling the direction of superhero comics for the past 20 years. Maybe we should just forget those guys. As much as I love Moore, you know what I mean? Maybe we should just forget that and just start writing stories that are unique and aren't just playing into this same tired dichotomy of hope versus cynicism.
Right.
It was very strange. Once I saw that, the metatextual elements of like, oh, look, it was Watchmen ruined everything. It was a lot harder to swallow. So I'm like, oh, wait, but you're still just riffing on the same thing that, you know, Grant Morrison did. So Long story short, go read Animal Man. It's a great comic. The original Grant Morrison version.
Yeah, the Grant Morrison run is, it's rough around the edges, but ultimately the payoff at the end is super awesome.
That emotional punch at the end is, it's awesome.
Yeah. Also, there's a moment where Animal Man and Martian Manhunter hang out, and it's kind of like, they're like, yeah, we're kind of just like B-level, you know, superheroes. Like, do you want to just go fly over the Grand Canyon for a little bit and chill out? Like, it was the most like random little one-off in that whole run.
That sounds fantastic.
I really enjoyed it.
Such a good book. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I also say the one thing that sort of caught my eye that I wasn't really crazy about was this sort of why not both mentality of pre-52 and new 52 with this idea that, well, we can either have, we can either have the old Blue Beetle, Ted Kord, or we can have, you know, Jaime Reyes, the new Blue Beetle. Well, we need to appeal to everybody, so let's just put both in, even though it doesn't really feel necessary.
I don't even know what was happening there. There's all of a sudden this kid had a beetle on his neck and he flew away. Like, okay, sure.
Right. And that's Jaime Hernandez or Jaime, or however you want to say it. Jaime Hernandez, or Jaime Reyes. I'm confusing creators with characters.
Yeah.
Jaime Reyes, who was the Blue Beetle during the New 52. It only made it to like 19 issues, I think. But it was really, it was an interesting comic, and it obviously featured a person of color as the solo main character. And that's a big deal that DC has, not performed greatly in recently. And it felt like an unfair compromise because obviously there were people complaining during the whole New 52, Blue Beetle is supposed to be Ted Kord, white, unsurprising, white heterosexual male protagonist. And so you ended up with two Blue Beetles. I'm trying to think of the other one where you ended up with both as well. Oh, you ended up with both Adams, Ray Palmer and Ryan Choi, I think is his name. So you just... Yeah, and I think there was another situation as well where you have both the old one and the new one because clearly you're not, brave enough to either, put forth the new, maybe less appealing to the old guard character, and yet you also know that bringing back the old guard character by itself is going to bring about a massive, wonderful PR, moment for you. So.
Yeah. I think what I need is the annotated Nick and Paul version of this comic.
Yeah.
Like page by page, just narrated director's cut copy where Paul and Nick explain DC to me, because ultimately you guys are you're saying this stuff and I'm like, oh, I had no clue what was going on in that scene apparently. And I inferred like a lot of things, but at the same time, like questions like, oh, there's another Blue Beetle, there Ted Kord is a Blue Beetle, is that a thing, is this like Power Rangers now? I have no idea.
And that Jaime Reyes thing where Dr. Fate says that the beetle on his back is not extraterrestrial but it's magical, what the fuck is that
Dr.
is
Fate
so stupid.
Yeah.
And the best part is I can say that because nobody read Blue Beetle during the New 52, so nobody even knows enough to stand up and correct me on how dumb that is.
I'm sure there are dozens of you, Nick. There are dozens.
Yeah. Dozens. I like how you said dozens. You really safely couched it in a very small amount of people. There are going to be 12 or more people that are going to be real upset about this.
Yeah,
I guarantee it.
So, Paul, what are you excited for this week?
Extra, extra, read all about it. Paper Girls is back from hiatus. Paper Girls number 6. This book, I really, really enjoyed it, even though I could not possibly tell you why other than the artwork. The story is meandering in this way that it doesn't feel like it doesn't know where it's going. There's definitely an endpoint in mind. It's just taking the scenic route to get there, it feels like. And the way that issue 5 ended with that sort of big last page reveal that we're getting sort of a jump forward in time, I'm very excited to see where it's going to go next. This book is so strange. I mean, when I sit back and think about the story and why I enjoy it, I couldn't put it into words. But so much of its appeal, again, is Cliff Chiang's artwork, which is simply gorgeous. It's such a beautiful looking book. The color palette that's being used, these weird pastels and pinks and purples, it's basically one of the most unique looking books on the stands, and I'm willing to be confused completely by the story just to enjoy the artwork in some instances.
I totally agree with that. This book is crazy and out there in a way that I thought Why the Last Man was crazy and out there, but this is exactly. This is a whole nother level.
Yeah.
Do you guys think I would like this? I mean, I feel we're far enough removed from the first arc to say this, but someone, I think it was Kate, was trying to tell me stuff about this, and she's like, it's a monster thing, but then it's like an alien thing, but then it's not, it's like, but so then you're not sure.
Nick, I was like, did you like the movie Super 8, the Abrams, J.J. Abrams?
Like
the
Spielberg? Because I heard it was kind of like, I know it was supposed to be a big summer blockbuster and fizzled. I haven't seen it. I'm not opposed to seeing it, but go ahead. Sorry, I heard it was Encounters, right? Close Encounters?
Yeah, I mean, it's a riff on Spielbergian teenage kids with this sort of giant otherworldly sort of thing going on in the background. That's the closest pitch to it, but that's only like the first couple issues. Then it becomes this weird like monster time travel thing.
Yeah.
So I will sell it simply on the art in that case. If you're able to get a copy cheap and just it just be your jaw drops at the beauty of the pages, it's worth it. So
yeah, that sounds like it's like smashing between a whole bunch of different 80s genres. Is that wrong? Mm-hmm.
No,
that's totally right.
It's a book that's indebted. It's a book that's indebted to 80s pop culture, but not just as like a reference. It's indebted to that sort of, these kids, there's no thing as the internet. There's no cell phones. It's like you're very much in that time period, and it influences the direction the story takes. So
tape decks and cocaine.
Exactly. All across the board. Yep.
Yeah. Nick, what about you? What are you excited for this week?
I know ties are, you know, morally repugnant on this program.
Yes.
And I try to avoid them as much as possible. But this week, it's sort of an ideological battle between a series that has proven itself and a series that is about to be reborn. See what I did there? That was terrible.
Perfect.
DC, I'll take my $10 to my P.O. box. So you've got 4001 AD number 2. I am very excited for that. I think 4001 AD number 1 was great. I'm very excited to see, because I'm a red-blooded American, I'm excited and eagerly awaiting some hot rye-on-rye action in the next issue. It's going to be a battle, guys. It's going to be a big showdown, hope. And I love Eternal Warrior. It's so cool to see. It's so funny whenever you have a Valiant book that jumps all over the place in time. He's still alive and well wherever. You just got to find him, and he's just old and still beating shit up. Mm-hmm. So it's glad to see that never changes. Clayton Crane art, guys. Clayton Crane, when I look at his work, I don't know how he puts it out month after month. It's just staggering and it's amazing. And I'll plug Comixology too. If you ever buy this book and get the digital exclusive pages at the end, it's got, and no offense to the lettering or any of that, but it's got all of that stripped away and you just have the art for a couple pages, and it's just fantastic. But it's between that, and I hate to say that this is a book that needs to prove itself because people are going to be mad when I say this, but Batman, God, what is this stupid title? Is this like Batman : Rebirth special number one one-shot? I don't know. It's the one-shot Batman book going into the ongoing. That's what I'll call it. And it's got a couple things on the surface that look good. It's a $2.99 book with 32 pages, 33 of which will be ads. Just kidding. It's co-written by Snyder. So that's great. Not that I don't believe in Tom King, but I think this is going to be Snyder's maybe last official Batman contribution. Mm-hmm. And it's got Mikael Janine's art instead of David Finch's, which, let's be clear, I liked David Finch on Forever Evil. I thought that was great, but I don't like David Finch all the time. Just in small, you know, small bursts, especially because I don't like how he draws certain female characters. Yikes. But it sounds interesting, and the fact that Tom King's first character or villain that he's willing to go after is Calendar Man, like, you got balls if the first thing you're going to do is Calendar Man. Like, and I hope he doesn't go the track of making him just tries to really just make him grim and gritty and dark and be like, see, Calendar Man can be hardcore too. He likes March and no one else does. I hope they go with some sort of like mania or obsession or OCD sort of thing with like his like fanaticism for the calendar. I think that would be a good approach. And Tom King's like, you fucking idiot, I wrote this issue months ago, but thanks for your armchair, you know, advice, Nick White. I work in the CIA, I know where you live. Worked in the CIA, maybe he still does, who knows. But that's my tie.
That's
and
okay.
We'll see where this Batman thing goes. I'm interested.
me too. Cool. I think Tom King on Batman could be very exciting. I think that's a good match. So yeah,
I need to read more Tom King. I think I need to finish. I need to read all of Omega Men. I think is what needs to happen, and then the Vision. Yeah. So you know,
just picked up the last issue of that yesterday. Last issue on the stand too. Nick, why did you never pull this book during the 12 issues? I don't know. I'm weird. Ignore me.
You're lucky. You're lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me this week, I'm excited for the book that I'm still going to champion until the day it ends, All New Wolverine number 9. And I say it like that because, unfortunately, I don't know how well this book sells, but it is fantastic. All New Wolverine is one of the most fun X-Men books you can read. It's probably, like I've said before, it's probably the best X-Men book you can read because Laura Kinney is the best and her sidekick clone sister is hilarious. And it's a really fun, like, coming of age book where this not so old Wolverine who's seen all this bad stuff is trying to make life not so bad for her, like, clone sister. And they have a pet Wolverine and that's hilarious. And this book is just great. It's action-packed, but it's also very heartwarming, and there's a lot of emotion coming from both of these characters, and I don't think you get that with X-Men. Well, I mean, you get that with X-Men all the time, but it's usually just, it's wrapped around drama and stupid plot. And instead, this book is really just heartfelt, and I really appreciate that about a character who I really cherish. I really love X-23. She's by far one of my favorite X-Men characters, and I will, like I said, read this book forever. As long as it keeps getting printed, I will be buying this book, so can't recommend it enough.
Does the clone have the healing factor as well, or the adamantium or anything, or is the clone just literally a...
Well, yes and no. The clone...
I opened one of these.
It's really oh, bizarre. No. It's really bizarre. It's explained in the first couple of issues of this series. How bizarre.
Yes.
She doesn't have the claws as far as I know. I don't believe she does. She doesn't have any pain receptors. They, like, turn that off in her. And, yeah, it's really weird. I don't know if she has healing factor. It's very limited. But she's also dying because she's an imperfect clone. So it's a really complicated story. But she's the only one of the, like, four clones that survived in this storyline. And there's something different about her, I think. So that's one of the longer plots that are being slowly explored as the story goes on. So we have yet to figure out what exactly is going to happen, but so far it's like issue number 7 was a one shot, issue number 8 starts the new story arc, and so far it's been very good. So I would say just go find the first volume of this. It's very well worth your money, I think.
Okay.
I guess I was just sort of worried that maybe the clone wasn't picking up the slack and, if she was capable of actually fighting as well.
Well, that's the thing. Like, in the story, Laura, she keeps trying to protect this clone, saying, or protect her sister. I'm going to call her sister because that's really how this relationship works between the two of them. She's constantly trying to protect her sister and saying, I don't want you to experience the bad life that I had. So you should stay back. You should, stay at the apartment, eat the Chinese food. You know, don't go out. That was actually last issue. Stay at the house. Shield's coming. Don't get involved. And then she gets involved, and it's hilarious and cute. And yeah, so Laura's trying to constantly protect her as this, like, I don't want you to have the bad life. But her sister keeps coming to her saying, I've had the bad life already. Like, I'm only 13, and I've already had all this bad shit happen to me. So don't try to protect me because I can take care of myself, but I also want to, be with you. You're the only connection to this world that I have, so stop trying to push me away. So it's a really good story. I don't know. Sisters trying to bond. That's interesting.
Yeah. I just think the main fascinating takeaway from this is that Mike Rapin's best X-Men book right now is a solo character book. Yeah. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. It's kind of surprising. Usually I'm an Uncanny X-Men kind of guy, but that book is all sorts of all over the place right now, so I'm going to just leave that be. So this week's topic is all about comic book guilty pleasures, which is kind of an interesting idea since I wrote this idea down months and months ago. Like, the way that we, work with our show, I'll give you a little bit of metasphere information, is like we as a group of podcasters, we sit down, we write down a bunch of topics, and then I sign out people, we schedule, and then we mash the topic in with the people that are going to be on the episode. And this is one that I wrote down like I said, a while ago, and I just thought, hey, this would be a good thing to talk about. Comic book guilty pleasures. What are these books? What are books or series that we've read that we're kind of just ashamed of, or we're, you know, we realize this is really bad and we still like it, things like that. Like the same way you'd have guilty pleasures with music, where, you know, if you're, you know, a hardcore death metal fan, but you listen to Taylor Swift because it just makes you feel right. Like, and there's nothing wrong with that, I guess, because really there is no shame in it. It's just a matter of like, this doesn't conform to what you may think of me as a comic book reader, but I still really enjoy it. So this topic kind of doesn't work, because I think between Nick, Paul, and I, we don't really have books that we're like ashamed of, that we're hiding in our, you know, our long boxes underneath and behind another book so that you won't see it. You know, hidden behind X-Men is Gem and the Holograms, but that's not a bad book, right? That shouldn't be a book that I'm ashamed of reading. So when we think about comic book guilty pleasures,
you gotta be hiding that X-Men book.
You know, like, yeah, I should be hiding all my X-Men, right? I should be hiding that Chuck Austin run of Uncanny X-Men that I have that is so awful.
Oh, God.
But that, nonetheless, like, so yeah, that kind of begs the question, like, if you have guilty pleasures about comics or in your, you know, books that you've read or books that you've enjoyed, like, what are they, or are they really guilty pleasures?
Yeah, I mean, Mike, you did a nice job explaining my viewpoint, because I've never really understood the idea of having a guilty pleasure in terms of music or, you know, anything, any type of pop culture thing, because if you enjoy it, that's fine. Like, why would you feel guilty about enjoying it? Again, this is coming from someone that bought and enjoyed the 4-issue Archie Meets Kiss comic book. I mean, yeah. I'm not going to say it's like the best comic book I've ever read, but I enjoyed it. I'm not going to feel guilty because it might seem strange or anything else. The idea of feeling guilty, so maybe that's the tricky word there, is guilt. I mean, there's certainly books that I've bought that I wondered why exactly I dropped $3 or $4 a pop on. That's kind of more of the guilt I have, is like, I can't believe I threw my money away on this stuff. So, and that's always stuff you feel more obligated to buy because it's part of a tie-in or part of an event or people are talking about it. If you trust your gut and you buy Gem and the Holograms because you love it, never feel guilty about it, but feel guilty by the books you buy out of obligation. When I was buying books, when I first started reading comic books, I was reading Wizard magazine, and they were recommending a ton of X-Men comics, and they were recommending a ton of Gen 13 and Early Image and Youngblood and all this stuff. All those books were terrible when I read them, but I felt obligated to buy them, right? That said, when I was at the Comic Con earlier today, I did buy a bunch of old issues of Gen 13, and I was kind of second-guessing myself, like, these are not going to be good. But I remember reading them as a kid, and I kind of want to just have a weird nostalgia trip, so I'll gamble the dollar a piece on them. So guilt isn't really the issue. I guess it's more of just justifying what you're reading in a weird way. So never try to feel you have to justify what you're reading by saying, oh, it's not popular, but I like it. No, if you like it, that's the only thing that matters. I'll get off my soapbox now.
I think that's a fantastic point, though. You know, we sometimes read things, and actually going back to what you said about, you know, buying a book because it's a tie-in, because you want the full story, and you're, you know, trying to justify the money for these kinds of things. And that's unfortunately what I felt about DC Rebirth. You know, the Universe Rebirth number one, I was like, I have to be in the know. Like, I really want to be in the know about this. And now I've, you know, I've spent the $3 on the you know, the Michelangelo God-touching finger thing, whatever cover that they had. It was the last copy,
hey man,
so.
Jeff John said he'll refund you. He said it in an article. This is true. You let him know. You hate it. He will write you a check for $3.
But that's the thing. It's not that I hated the book, right? I know that we just spent a bunch of time talking about DC Rebirth, so I don't necessarily want to harp on that fact anymore. But it's not that I didn't like the book. It's just that I don't know if it was worth my money, because I don't think I'm going to continue reading it. It's like regret that I bought it. I didn't dislike it. I wouldn't want Jeff Johns to give me back money for it, because I'm glad that I read it, but I didn't enjoy it. And sometimes we have these purchases like that where you read something, you're really hyped about it, or everyone's saying you got to read this, and then you read it and you're like, that was really underwhelming. Like, why did I spend my money on that? And I wonder,
and that's not a guilty pleasure, right?
Right.
I mean, I think that's where we're drawing the line here. I mean, there's consumer regret over something not being what you thought it was going to be. Is a totally different bag.
Yeah, yeah,
sure. Yeah.
So, I mean, when I think of guilty pleasures now for myself, like I mentioned that Chuck Austin run of Uncanny X-Men, to this day, I still own those trades. When I moved to New York and I gave up a ton of my comic books, you know, I donated them, that run of X-Men stayed with me because it's so, as bad as it is in a lot of ways, it's so closely tied to what I remember being really exciting about comic books. Reading New X-Men side by side with Uncanny X-Men, mm-hmm. side by side with Extreme X-Men, which I actually read much later because at one point I had a real problem with Chris Claremont, and I was totally wrong about that. But having those books, you know, knowing all of that continuity, that's like my comic book reading origins, and I can't ever give that up. You know, like you said with those Gen 13 books, like you know that those books are bad, but you wanted to own them. You wanted to be able to hold on to that memory, even if they aren't that good. And if someone saw them on your shelf, you'd be like, well, ignore that. It's not my proudest moment, but this is mine.
And the funny thing about that is, like, I can't even say, like, oh, I bought those when I was 13. Because I did, but I sold them.
Yeah.
And I bought them again for really no reason whatsoever. So.
Yeah. But it's a question of then at that point is, you know, we've talked about this a couple times on the show about holding on to that memory of a comic, of reading comics, of old comics that got you invested in, allowed you to figure out, you know, maybe these weren't the best comics, but at the time when I read them, they were important to me. And now, since I've, you know, I moved on from them, maybe they're not the best, but they still are important to me personally. They may not be great books in the greater whole of comics continuity and everything like that, but they're still important to you in a certain level.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But Nick, let me. You haven't spoken in. You haven't chimed in on this. I'm really concerned. Are you?
Sure.
Do you have like a lot of guilt about your comics?
I'm okay. I'm thinking. I'm thinking here. I'm processing the gears. All seven of them are turning. I think what's interesting about guilty pleasures is that it sort of tries to dictate one's idea of their identity formation, and that, like, if you're Paul, for example, you like what you like, you read what you want, you buy what you buy, and that makes you who you are, and there's no problem with that. And I think the whole idea of the notion of the guilty pleasure is that your reading needs to be done within certain lines. You either need to be a Marvel fan or a DC fan, or you need to be an indie comic fan. And if you aren't one of those, if you don't subscribe to one of these camps, well then, if you subscribe to one of these camps because that's what they want you to do, and then you choose to deviate from such, those are your guilty pleasures, right? I mean, that's the whole idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're going and reading Marvel books, and oh, that's so scandalous. You're a DC reader, and so they've codified things in a way where, you know, there's good and there's bad, and I think that that's sort of the industry benefits off of this idea of a guilty pleasure because they want you in their camp wholeheartedly. And, you know, when I started reading singles for the first time, I was very, very much a DC fan. I'm still somewhat a DC fan, even if you go listen to that Rebirth part and you're like, how the fuck am I going to get that impression? And so I didn't diversify, one, because it was easy, and two, because it was like, well, you know, I don't want to read that stuff. I'm going to feel like I'm missing out on things. And so that whole idea of a guilty pleasure kind of weaved its way into things. But it's tricky to think about. You know, I don't feel bad about what I read, and I don't want people to feel bad about telling me what they like to read. But there's still definitely an idea of, like, putting your best foot forward. You know, if someone came up to me and said, you know, my name is Bob and I own 7 omnibuses of Crossed, it would be very hard for me to, you know, say, you do you, girl. But I'm also not going to be the person, you know, I also don't want to be that person who says you should be ashamed to read that. Yeah, it's tricky. Or if you like Xenoscope and sexy Snow White and little red double D's or whatever they call her. you know, again, like, it's a real moral situation because you want to say read what you want to read, but you also maybe don't want to be wholeheartedly supportive of that. I don't know. I think, well, like, that's what I was mulling over yesterday in my brain. It's like sort of tricky. I don't want someone to come after me and go, well, geez, like, seems like you read all of that Valiant. Have you tried anything else? And then I'm like, oh, I read a lot of independent Dark Horse comics. I'll let you know. No.
Push up your glasses
listen,
a little bit. And...
Listen, Dick. That's how I start most conversations. Maybe I shouldn't, but you got to start with a strong offense, right?
It's funny because I think, I mean, the idea of a guilty pleasure, not just in comics, but even in music, it's the idea that it reinforces, maybe not what you were saying, Nick, of like publishers wanting allegiance, but it reinforces the idea of there being like an acceptable canon of what's like good
comics
or what's good comics. And like if it's something that's like, if you like, you know, in music terms, like, oh, you're supposed to really like Pink Floyd, but if you like the Monkees, that should be a guilty pleasure. I'm like, well, no, I like the Monkees a lot more than Pink Floyd. Why, like, why would I apologize for that?
And alternatively, if you say Pink Floyd is bad,
well, right. That's a whole different discussion, I think.
That's a different discussion. I mean, but this, as an example, it's like, well, yeah, I mean, there can be sort of just like, I kind of love just like dumb superhero comics. I freely admit, like, that's why I like the Dark Side War, because I said it was a dumb comic book, like a dumb superhero story, and I loved it because of that. That wasn't a put down of those type of comics. It's just like sometimes that's really what you enjoy. Not everything you read needs to be Paper Girls or, you know, mm-hmm. or Saga or this a brilliant masterpiece. You can enjoy
multi Eisner winners. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I only read books that have won an Eisner.
So. I would but very I much like to meet
hope
that
you like
person.
Slice of life. That's all you're getting.
So I mean,
big fat slice of life.
So the idea of guilty pleasure, I think, it reinforces that idea that there's an acceptable quality or content that you have to like adhere to when you're reading comics. And I've always been of the mind that to reach across the board. When I went to the Comic Con earlier today, I was like, let me just buy stuff I've never seen before and I've never heard of.
Right.
I'll gamble 50 cents or a dollar just to try, just to broaden my horizons. Yeah. So guilty pleasures, they're not, there should be no guilt. It's just a way of like expressing just how broad your appeal or your interests are in comics, I guess.
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
totally. No, I agree completely. I mean, when I, you know, I might tell someone I really like, you know, Judge Dredd versus Predator versus Aliens, and for a lot of people, that's two strikes right there. One for massive franchise abuse,
yeah,
and two for being a stupid non-canon crossover, right? Yeah. I mean, I'm double dipping right there. But that's, you know, that's what I like, and I think the more you read comics, and this is true of virtually any consumable media, the more you consume, the more you diversify, mm-hmm. because you realize you can't fill your life with just one type of comic book. It's just, I think for most people, there's a point where you're like, you know, I've got to try something else, or I've got to really, you know, branch out, because mm-hmm. this just isn't emotionally fulfilling, I guess.
Well, eventually you start seeing the patterns, you start being able to predict the stories, which is why, you know, we'll love
see the code in the Matrix.
Right, and which is why we like, you know, B-movies, you know? We like these cheesy horror movies sometimes because it's like, I know the villain's going to be this, I know this is going to happen, these characters are playing these stereotypes, and that's really fun. And in some, you know, in some ways, people would say, well, that's a guilty pleasure. You know that it's bad, or you know that it's, you know, in some fashion, it is considered bad. And but you're okay with that, and you rely on the predictability of the medium sometimes to say, you know, like, I know what's going to happen. This isn't surprising, but it's something that I don't have to think about. I don't have to analyze. And maybe that's what we're getting at here. Like, Paul, you were kind of mentioning, you know, Dark Side War was something that was just like a big, dumb superhero comic book. But you liked that because
I love that
you
stuff,
knew the
yeah.
beats. You knew what was going to happen. The characters were going to play to their tropes. And that's enjoyable because it was predictable in a way. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, right?
Exactly.
Another great example is just before we did this, perhaps for inspiration, I read, I might get this title wrong, but it's basically, it was Ash Goes to Space.
Wait, from Ash from the Evil Dead?
You're damn right. Written by not only one only Cullen Bunn.
Fantastic.
Wow. And I think, you know, stuff like that you're supposed to feel bad about, you know, because it's, you know, it's inconsequential, or it's franchise, or maybe there's not a strict canon, or maybe it's not going to win an award for its art, or maybe the plot isn't the most unique thing out there. But as you were saying, with a lot of these books, especially the ones that we are quote-unquote supposed to feel bad about, it's because they're predictable. It's because it's the same story every time. And yeah, if I go read a Predator story, is he going to kill a bunch of people that aren't interested in being dead one by one? Yeah, I mean, okay, sometimes he kills them in groups of two. He diversifies, and that's fine. He has a lot of weapons on him. If you've seen the Predator, that's his job, killing people. But it's the same beat a lot of the time. And Ash versus the Evil Dead, same thing. Is he going to kill a bunch of Deadites? Yes. Is his hand going to go evil at some point? He's going to have to chop it off, replace it with a chainsaw. The hand's going to try to kill him. Eventually, an evil version of Dark Ash is going to show up and team up with the hand and try to kill him. Yeah, absolutely. This is going to happen every damn fucking time. Does that mean I care? No. There's something about knowing what's going to happen, and there's something oddly enjoyable about that, that I like, and conversely, is something I'm supposed to be feeling bad about.
Go ahead, Paul.
I was just going to say, like, maybe the term guilty pleasure seems loaded. I think books we're talking about are books that we recognize aren't great, but they're comfortable. Mm-hmm. So it's like comfort food, right? It's like eating meatball sub. Like, yeah, this is bad for me, but it's kind of just what I want right now.
Right.
So find your comic book version of the meatball sub. And embrace it.
Paul works for Subway.
Episode sponsored by Subway.
Clearly they didn't have a spokesperson for a while, so they needed someone new.
Yikes. But we could think of examples, and it might be a different topic, maybe for a different show. But books you should feel guilty for liking, right?
Oh goodness!
And that is
interesting.
That would have less to do with the content and I think more the production, because like there's ethical issues when it comes to creator rights. I mean, if a book was made under a hire for contract or contract for work scenario and the creator doesn't have the rights to the work anymore, it's like, yeah, maybe I should feel guilty for giving DC and Marvel this much money for stuff that when it was created might have been exploitive, right?
Right.
Maybe
or
I should
especially feel... if the people haven't gotten their due, like right. The whole Rocket Raccoon controversy.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Or I mean creators that, you know, nowadays, like we've talked about previously on this podcast, like creators that have knowingly been involved in scandals or have been harassers, or you know, there are certain creators that I won't read their books because I've heard stories and you hear accusations. And if you enjoy those books, maybe you should feel guilty, but again, that might be a different topic for a different show.
Yeah, I think we have planned in the future at least an episode about how to deal with the controversy in comic books. So that's eventually coming down the road, because I think that's something we've obviously seen more and more of in the past 5 years, and it's becoming something like almost a moral question of like, you're really supporting that book? You're supporting that creator that did X? You know, and it's a question of, can you separate the creator from their work, and should you be supporting someone that does these types of things? And that's a whole monster. Like that's a box.
That's
a
can of worms.
Of worms, Pandora's box, whatever you want to say. Trinity of sin, new, all different, all that kind of stuff. You know.
Can I just say I like that Marvel's new campaign is called Marvel Now, when their campaign from like 3 years ago was called Marvel Now.
Yeah, well, this one has an exclamation point, I think.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. You ought to feel guilty about that, Marvel.
Yeah, I can't say that I've had a comic book that I've felt guilty about or anything like that in a while. But I think that, you know...
Are there any books that you read that maybe you think maybe this is not the first thing I would mention to someone that I really thoroughly enjoy?
Well, that's actually an interesting question, because, you know, I champion for this book Jonesy, right? But I think that if someone asked me, what's a book that I should read? I don't know if I'd throw them Jonesy. Maybe they'd give me a weird look, because it's about this, like, teenage girl who has, like, these love powers. And maybe that doesn't seem like the kind of book that, you know, your typical comic book geek would read, but I totally enjoy the hell out of that book. I don't necessarily feel guilty reading it, but I think I might get like a weird eye from some people if they're outside of the comic book realm. Because I think once you're inside this bubble of comic book readership where you've, you know, seen things and you're reading the previews book or whatever, you know a little bit of information.
I've seen things.
You realize that, you know, like diversifying your reading by jumping or picking up books that are maybe out of your wheelhouse becomes something that is like a regular deal. But that wouldn't necessarily be the first thing, but it all depends on the person too. I mean, we've talked about comic book recommendations a million times, so I don't want to necessarily retread that, but there are some books where I go, maybe this isn't the first thing I'd recommend to you because it might seem a little odd. So I don't know. I don't know if you guys have anything like that as well.
I remember buying a few issues of a book called Birdland that Gilbert Hernandez did, one of the guys from Love and Rockets. He drew these comics for a company called Eros Comics, E EROS, if that tells you what the books are about.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly graphic.
Oh, okay.
They are
okay.
Love.
Shockingly love. Shockingly graphic books that I was just kind of curious. I knew that he'd done them, and I knew that some of the stories had characters from his Love and Rockets stories in them. And I was picking them up out of the bin, and I was kind of just very quickly trying to pay for them because mm-hmm. I knew what the contents
oh,
were.
Oh, okay, okay.
And I got home, and then I looked. I'm like, these contents are far more graphic than I actually expected them to
be. Oh, no.
And I just filed them in the back of the long box, like, okay, I have those. I'll probably never read them. I'll probably never show them to anybody or mention it besides in this context.
Well, now but we all know.
I guess that's kind of...
Besides now, yeah.
That was kind of the one thing I could point to. Is like, yeah, that's probably not something in my collection that I would really brag about owning right. or show anybody.
Well, so, now we got to turn to you, Nick. I mean, I don't know if I have anything necessarily like that. I mentioned my Chuck Austin run of Uncanny X-Men, so I think I've set the bar already. And Paul just raised it, so true. You got to top this, man.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, like, obviously, I think my obsession with, like, Alien and Predator comics is something that people feel is sort of redundant and stupid. And I was even telling Jordan about it, and Jordan goes, look, you don't understand. Like, Predators have rules, Nick. The Predators have a code of ethics they have to follow. And I'm like, what are you talking about? This is the most ridiculous shit I've ever heard. He's like, look, predators aren't supposed to kill the sick. They aren't supposed to kill the unarmed. They aren't supposed to kill women or children. And I'm thinking, like, the night before, I'm reading this comic where he kills a bunch of unarmed women, I think children, too. I'm like, what's going on, Jordan? He's like, well, look, you don't understand. There's actually a separate group of predators called the Bad Bloods, and they don't follow the rules. Oh. And they do whatever they want, and they get in trouble with the ones that are supposed to enforce this. I'm like, this is the most insane
Wait,
shit.
So is there like a Predator v. Predator book out there where it's like these two factions going head to head? Because I think I might try to pick that up.
The Bad Bloods wear like studded leather jackets and ride motorcycles and
mohawks.
Put Brile cream in their hair.
Yeah.
We're the Bad Bloods.
Oh my goodness.
Just listen to... Anyway,
yeah, Taylor Swift, yeah,
that,
that's what it would be.
Know.
The theme would just be Taylor Swift, Bad Blood, nonstop, on repeat till you finish that graphic novel.
But there are things like RoboCop. I do read RoboCop on occasion, and I think RoboCop, obviously, even the movie, you know, from people that are outside observers or who don't understand satire, you know, RoboCop is like an unadulterated gore fest, without any meaning or morality to it. And I do like that. Evil Dead is another, on a slightly different note, I don't like telling people I read Aquaman.
Oh, but that's like a dead...
Come on.
That's like a dead thing. Come on. Like, you can't be ashamed of any DC character, I think, at this point. Marvel's
sure,
in the same
sure.
boat, probably, too. But, yeah. I mean, let me just shame you for having shame, Nick.
Yeah. I mean, Aquaman's quite a bit safer now, but...
Yeah, he's got Jason Momoa on your side. You're fine. Don't worry about it.
I don't know if I want him on my side after some of the weird, creepy things he's been saying at cons, but aside from that...
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think those are probably a couple of mine. I'm racking my brain. I read Captain Canuck. That one's a little, like...
See, but you laugh about it. You're having a good time with it, so don't worry about it.
See?
Judge Dredd... The old Judge Dredd is another one, I think... I
love
it.
You can't feel guilty about that. Yeah, that stuff's awesome. But it's awesome, but it's you really have to preface it for people that only know Judge Dredd from like the recent Dredd movie. Like, okay, this is nothing like Keith Urban. Right? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Early Dredd Judge comics are so satirical and so kind of goofy in a way that maybe hasn't aged well,
Carl
especially
Urban.
Carl
Urban.
Keith's brother, right?
Yeah.
So but they haven't the humor hasn't aged in a way that I think especially American audiences could really like say like, whoa, this is badass. Cause it's really not, it's just like a satire. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
So long story short, or, you know, moral of the story here is don't be ashamed of your comics because comic books are fantastic.
Exactly.
except for that one thing that Paul just told us about. That one needs to stay where it is and never see the light of day again.
Sometimes you unwittingly buy a comic that is not for not for children or really anybody. So
to paraphrase a famous Daniel Day-Lewis film, there will be boobs. Which exactly. is probably also a movie by the point that I'm, you know, by this point, yeah. I'm certain that's also a movie title.
With several sequels.
There will be boobs, too boob, too furious.
Oh my goodness.
The bottom line is you shouldn't be ashamed about what you read, and you should, you know, try to actually openly advocate for the things that you like that you think other people might not really enjoy, because if we don't openly advocate for these things, we're just going to perpetuate this culture that you should feel bad about those things. And again, I just want to point out, that is totally true, except for the thing Paul mentioned, which again needs to stay locked away.
I'm sure if I sat down and actually read it, I'd be like, you know, look, the Gilbert Hernandez, yes, this is an incredibly graphic, you know, depiction of some activity that I'm not quite familiar with, but just look at the panel to panel transition, the page layout, it's actually quite brilliant. I'm not sure I'm willing to give it that level of a close read.
Yes. That's the line Paul's going to tell the parents when they accidentally borrow this. The panel layout. But really? I mean, the panel layout is...
Yeah. Look at this ink work. The brush work on this anatomy is amazing.
Please don't take me to jail.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast. Our host and producer is Mike Rappin, and the show is edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Damu the Fudge Monk and Infinity Shred. You can find more of Damu the Fudge Monk on Bandcamp at damuthefudgemonk.bandcamp.com. And you can find more of Infinity Shred at infinityshred.com. Shout out to Podern Family, a collection of podcasters and their creations of almost any topic you can imagine. If you're looking for new shows, check out the Podern Family hashtag on Twitter and support small podcasts like us. You can find more of this podcast at our website, ircb.us, or through the podcatcher of your choice. Remember, if you enjoy this show, tell someone about it. Rate us online. Write to us. Send us email at ircb@destroythesybe.org. You can also find the entire podcast team on Twitter, and you can follow the show at ircbpodcast. And don't forget, you can join and spark conversations over on our subreddit at ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. And again, from all of us here at the podcast, thank you for listening.
Yeah, so you saw X-Men Apocalypse. I didn't. I'm going to go see it next weekend because I couldn't bear actually going to the theater while there was a bunch of fucking weirdo X-Men fans. I'm like, Jesus.
Yeah, right. Like I was telling Paul, there was just too little for people to do. And the way the trailers came across, they sort of maybe gave you the idea that people were going to have a bigger role, and then they didn't. So that was kind of disappointing.
I did read a quote from Bryan Singer saying, like, he's like, boy, I really wish we could have had Jubilee using her powers in the movie. I really wanted to show that. I'm like, you're the director. Like, why didn't you?
Wait, like, maybe you forgot. This is your film. Maybe you forgot that you were in the greatest position to invoke change within this film itself.
Yeah,
that's okay.
But he didn't write it. So, I mean, how much can you do, I guess?
Sure. Yeah.
I don't know. That'll be fun to go cry at, because I'm so excited. I've heard nothing but bad things about that movie, so instead I went and saw The Nice Guys, and that movie was fucking awesome. I really enjoyed it, all things considered. It was clunky, but that's because it was a detective noir, and detective noirs are clunky. I've decided.
It was a good movie. It was a good movie. You know that you're in for a good movie when Shane Black drags the kid, the main kid from Iron Man 3, into his new movie. Just to basically, I don't want to spoil it, but it's, what a singular scene to, like, drag the kid over from one movie to another for, and then be like, all right, that's your part in this movie.
She was essentially the best detective in that whole movie, so if you haven't seen it, Xander, go see it.
Yeah.
Anyways, okay, let's get this.
No,
thing
no,
going.
No, not that kid. The one at the beginning with the car crash.
Oh yeah,
that
yeah,
was
yeah,
the
yeah,
young
yeah.
boy from Iron Man 3.
Oh, I did not catch that. I thought you were talking about the little girl.
No, no, you were right. She was the best detective, though.
Yeah.
Anyway,
all right,
Paul, you'd like
so,
it.
Yeah, it's fantastic.